The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 173.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. She is really, really awesome. And by the way, I'm going to go out on a limb and say she's most likely the only Fed employee to ever step foot in a Louis Vuitton. Danielle, am I right about that?
My soles are red.
Well, Danielle DiMartino Booth, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. So just before we started recording, you were saying that there was some big news that you were kind of thinking through about the election and how that might play out over the macroeconomic landscape. So let's just dive into that.
Well, I mean, you know, so I've been thinking for the last few hours, okay, I'm going to talk to George. We're going to talk about housing. We're going to talk about commercial real estate. We're going to be real estate-y. And, you know, when I look at Senator Toomey, who's trying to hold the line because the Democrats in Congress want to keep open the Fed's municipal bond facility.
Right.
Right? They want to make sure that they can bail out states that are suffering flight, like Illinois, like New Jersey. And they're obviously their real estate markets have suffered accordingly when your tax base starts to erode and people are going to other no income tax states. So I think this is just we're at such a fascinating juncture in this K-shaped recovery that it's come down to a matter of two Senate races in Georgia determining so much of what happens in Fed policy going forward, in fiscal policy going forward, in tax rates going forward. Because if the Democrats are afraid that the Senate's going to hold on to those two seats, that the Republicans are going to hold on to those two seats in the Senate, and that the Senate's not going to flip, they're not going to be able to raise capital gains taxes. They're not going to be able to raise federal income taxes. So they're not going to be able to bail out these states effectively, unless that Fed's municipal bond facility that Steve Mnuchin said he was closing as it expired as per the CARES Act on December the 31st.
Right.
If they can't keep that open, they don't have a side way around to get to these state bailouts. I mean, this is really critical stuff when you think about how underfunded some of these states' pensions are and what their remedies are, which in many cases is raising property taxes.
Yeah. So how does Janet Yellen play into that?
Oh, gosh. I mean, Janet Yellen is, look, this is, it's no surprise for anybody who's ever read Fed Up. I'm not a huge fan. Look, she, in 2010, she basically said, I didn't understand what an off-balance sheet vehicle was. I didn't know what a CLO was. This was in congressional testimony. I didn't see the crisis coming. Mm-hmm. So this is a labor economist. She's a pure labor economist. And you say, well, why would the Democrats want to have a pure labor economist running the Treasury Department?
Right.
You can kind of understand Steve Mnuchin. A year ago today, we were worried about the Fed increasing the size of its not QE program because the overnight lending market had frozen up. And you know, these were very arcane, intricate dilemmas facing the financial markets that a labor economist would probably not have been equipped to address in that position, in those times. And we know that the financial markets have gotten increasingly complex as the Fed has bought up all the mortgages, the Fed's bought up all the treasuries, the Fed's propping up the corporate bond market, the Fed's propping up the stock market. So people are increasingly looking to volatility plays or currency plays or commodity plays, any place that the Fed is not. I mean, why else do you get lumber at $800? Your financial markets are getting increasingly complex and you're putting a labor economist educated at UC Berkeley in as Treasury Secretary to look over the financial system of the world effectively. Why are you doing that? Well, I mean, I'm being rhetorical, but there's a really good reason. There's a really, really good reason. Janet Yellen can cross the aisle. That was like the fairy tale time for Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike. Markets were going up. Volatility had vanished off the planet. She had the slowest tightening cycle of any Fed chair in the history, 107-year history of the Fed. Mm-hmm. So Janet Yellen is like this sweet fairy godmother that just delivers all this money and makes everybody happy. But what does she want to do? What is Janet Yellen bitter about? She's bitter that the labor force participation rate has never come back. And she wants to get these marginal buyers back into the workforce. If she doesn't, she wants to help them. Now, how do you help them when the Fed's quantitative easing only flows into risky assets, only flows into the top of the K, right, only helps that top 10%, or at least the 55% of Americans who own stocks in some way, shape, or form, or American homeowners? And we'll get to that. But how do you help them? You send them money. You just deposit the money into their accounts.
Right, right, right.
You do helicopter money. And how do you do helicopter money? Well, you got to have somebody who's a savvy enough political operator to bring both sides of the aisle together to reopen the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 and change the law and allow the Fed to buy treasuries at auction, which is illegal right now. And while we're at it, in April, she said on a CNBC interview that under the right circumstances, the Fed should be allowed to buy equities. So why not put that into the Federal Reserve Act just in case? And she's also said in the past that under the right circumstances, the Fed should be able to impose negative interest rates. That's against the law. Why not? If you've got the Federal Reserve Act open, hadn't been open since 1977 when they increased the single mandate to the dual mandate, which includes maximizing employment, which they've clearly exhibited they cannot do in the post-COVID world.
Right.
But why not have this sweet, quiet little grandmother looking figure say, oh, we'll just reopen the Federal Reserve Act. We'll fix everything. And we'll give you helicopter money. And by the way, the mother of all inflation. Yeah, that's what Janet Yellen can do.
When I heard that she got the job, the very first thing that came to my mind was MMT. Because the first step for MMT is when you take the balance sheet of the Fed and the Treasury and you just merge them into one balance sheet.
Exactly.
That's the step one procedure. I'm assuming that you're seeing this going the same direction there. Now, whether they want to call it that or not, who
they
knows?
They'll call it fixing the transmission mechanism of monetary policy.
Right, right.
So that it can get to where it needs to be in the form of universal basic income.
And then going back to Dr. Lacey Hunt, and I just always go back to that interview he had with Grant, where he was talking about how he would go from a deflationist to an inflationist. And he actually used the word hyperinflation.
Oh, yes.
If you turn bank reserves into legal tender or the Fed's balance sheet starts paying the bills. So
exactly.
Just for the layman here that's watching this, basically what we're talking about is the Fed starting to pay the bills or the two balance sheets merging and the Treasury just using newly created bank reserves as legal tender in the real economy.
Yep. And that is when I know Lacey well, and he is maintaining, but I think Lacey would change his tune on January the 5th if the Senate flips and you have a blue wave.
Basically, how he would be connecting the dots is if you have that blue wave, then in his mind, the Federal Reserve Act is definitely going to change.
It's perfectly plausible. Nobody would stop them. It would have to go to the Supreme Court eventually for check and balance. But if you have the administration, if you have the executive branch and the legislative branch holding hands, you can do whatever you want with the law.
Or don't you think they would also do whatever they want if we just have a big enough crisis? I mean, because we go back to March.
Sure, they did.
And nothing they did was true to the Federal Reserve Act when they're buying junk debt and setting up all these special purpose vehicles. So isn't that the other scenario where
and they don't have another encore, George? I don't mean to interrupt, but they have on March the 23rd. Look, I know people who have died from COVID. I'm not an anti-masker. I'm all about social distancing. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I'm none of those things. I'm very much in favor of people putting on your mask, whether you agree with it or not, so that you can keep small businesses in America open, period, end.
Right,
if everybody's wearing a mask, then you're going to have higher consumption in the economy. You're going to grow your GDP. You're going to reduce your unemployment rate, period, and full stop. People don't get that argument, then they shouldn't be listening to me or you. Anyways, I'm not putting words in your mouth. All of this being said, the Fed needed COVID. The Fed needed COVID. Again, a year ago, Jay Powell was struggling to say that not QE was a technical adjustment. We're just tweaking with the plumbing of the overnight rates market.
Right, and going back to repo, right.
And the banks are screaming for more reserves, screaming, saying, you know what, you did quantitative tightening. By the way, currency in circulation increased tremendously at the same time. And by the way, foreign central banks that have imposed negative interest rates in their countries, which is no fun, parked their money at the Fed. So you pulled, in order to get a better interest rate, paid by the Fed, paid by U.S. taxpayers. So all three of these things happened in concert. So when the Fed thought that it was going to do quantitative tightening, it ended up effectively tightening to twice the extent while raising interest rates, because you had money in circulation plus foreign central bank reserves parked at the Fed increased by an equal amount to quantitative tightening. So by the time we got to the end of 2019, the market was screaming for real QE, for the real deal.
Right.
But they couldn't launch real QE because that would be an admission that the economy needed it. That would be an admission that counterparty risk was rising. That would be an admission that instead of the subprime crisis, they had the mother of all corporate debt crises that was ballooning in front of their faces.
Mm-hmm.
I promise you, on somewhere around Halloween 2018, when General Electric's debt got downgraded and then high yield bond issuance froze for 41 record days, and then you had the bloodbath on Christmas Eve in the stock market, I promise you, people in the basement of the New York Fed then started devising a game plan for what they would do in the event of a black swan event. But they never thought that they'd have to roll it out before the black swan event. But that was what the market was, that was the point, that was the threshold that the market was already hitting at the end of 2019, with non-financial US debt to GDP at a record 78%. It hit 74% at the peak of the great financial crisis. So we entered the year in an economic recovery, in an expansion, with non-financial debt to GDP at 78%, posing greater systemic risk to the global financial system than the subprime crisis did a decade earlier. The Fed needed COVID. The Fed needed a black swan event because they needed to bail out the corporate bond market, which is exactly what they did. People were like, wow, they sure did come up with that plan quickly on March the 23rd.
Yeah.
Rolled out all those facilities at once. Bull. You can finish the word.
Right.
No, they had it ready to go. And they were able to grandfather in every fallen angel, every single investment grade bond that was downgraded to junk.
Right.
They said, well, we're going to grandfather in anything that's downgraded as of March the 22nd. So, problem solved. But now what happens? Now what happens if there's another problem? Because now we've got non-financial debt to GDP of 90%.
Daniel, can you just explain that stat? I heard you talking to Keith McCullough about that. And just for people that are familiar with just debt to GDP overall, can you explain that?
If you add up bonds and loans to every small and medium enterprise, by the way, small and medium enterprises, the blight does not have to be as bad as it is.
Right.
It doesn't. But small and medium enterprises had twice the debt load that they had going into the financial crisis coming into COVID.
Oh, okay.
You just think about AT&T's got, you know, $160 billion of debt on their balance sheet. Big companies have problems. Small and medium ones did as well. So when you add up all of the loans made to every company in America, because this is more than the corporate bond market, all debt in all forms, leverage loans, private.
The entire balance sheet of small and mid-sized businesses, right?
Plus large businesses. Then you get to non-financial debt. And then you measure that against GDP, and it was pushing $18 trillion at the end of 2019, a record percentage of GDP. And because of his bazooka solution, which kept open the bond market, it wrenched it open. But because of this, now we've got 90%. We've added $2.5 trillion in 1 year's, in three quarters time. Corporate America tacked on $2.5 trillion on top of that. So now he's made a bad situation worse. What's he going to do if the market blows up without a black swan event? Well, here comes Janet.
All right.
Here comes Janet. Just flat out monetize the debt.
Right. And, you know, when you're saying that, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about what Raul, Paul always says, that this is not a liquidity problem, that this is a solvency problem. No matter how much debt you pile onto the balance sheet, yes, it might buy you a little more time, but it doesn't solve the real problem. And that's that you just don't have enough cash flow coming in.
Right.
And at the end of the day, that has to do with the amount of goods and services that are being produced in the real economy, real wages, all those things. So back to Janet, the grandma wizard who waves the magic wand and combines the balance sheets and starts spending bank reserves directly into the real economy to in their mind, solve the cash flow problem.
And if you get the blue wave plus sweet Janet together, the sky's the limit. Green New Deal, Medicare for all, a pony, everything, except for the fact that you have runaway inflation. And that's where the MMT people get caught up. They're that's fine. We'll just raise income taxes. I'm sorry, but it's not that easy in this country.
Yeah. And for those people who might not follow along with what you're saying there as far as the income taxes, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I assume where you're going with that is where I've gone in several of my whiteboard videos, where if you look at the receipts, the tax receipts to GDP, you take that back as far as you want, to the 1940s even, and it's pretty darn consistent. It hovers right around 18% of GDP, regardless of whether the highest marginal rate is 90% or 25%. At a certain point, people just won't pay the taxes.
That's right.
And that's the big flaw with MMT and how they plan on squashing inflation, is just take money out of the system through taxation. But they don't ever come to the conclusion that, oh, wait, at a certain point, people just won't pay it. And if they don't pay it, it's not coming in. It's still out there creating inflation.
But you had one hedge fund manager a few years ago leave New Jersey and move to Florida. And they had to specially convene the New Jersey state legislature to revisit the budget because one person left the state. That's how much one person affected the revenue. You can't tell me that if you try and raise taxes to kingdom come, that people aren't going to be like, I hear New Zealand's great this time of the year.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, you know, another thing, too, that I think people miss is just the basics, that the wealth of our society isn't green pieces of paper. It's not stimulus checks. It's goods and services. Mm-hmm. And if we're producing less stuff as a society, regardless of how much MMT we're doing or UBI or whatever you want to call it, we're getting poorer as a society and as a nation. And everything that you're talking about, yes, it might just plug the problem momentarily, but it distorts the proper allocation of resources, which in the long run, basically, we produce less goods and services.
Of course we did.
We reduce the amount of wealth that's involved. I don't think most people really think that through.
No, I mean, look, I think one of the most formative moments of my life, I was at Wall Street, had a hiring freeze. I was in business school. So in between my first and second year of getting my MBA, Wall Street originally had me plan to go work in South America and Mexico. They said, go perfect your Spanish. Go do something. And once the hiring freezes up, we'll hire you. And I did go off to Wall Street, and I had my Spanish perfected because I lived in Venezuela for a summer where I had an internship at a massive steel conglomerate that has now been nationalized again. But I lived in Venezuela the summer before Chavez came in. The level of the income inequality divide, the level of poverty compared to the vast riches of their top 1% at the time, I'm 25 years old. I don't know anything about anything. I mean, I'm as naive as they come. I'd never even thought I would be an economist one day, ever. But there I am going, you know, this is a real problem. This could really boil over into something ugly. And sure enough, it did. And they brought socialism to their country and destroyed it in the process.
Yeah. You got all your productivity eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's transition a bit into the real estate topic. You sent me your report that I've got up on my screen here that's really, really cool. And of course, the first thing that jumped out at me was the information you had on hotels, New York, Hawaii, and San Francisco. And you know, it was interesting, Daniel, when I was reading all of the information about how the hotels are struggling, it took me back to a recent dinner I had with Robert Kiyosaki and Ken McElroy. And I don't know if you know Ken, but he's Robert's real estate investor guy. Okay. And he is thinking about putting a group of money together, or a pool of money, a fund to go in and buy distressed boutique hotels. And I was thinking about that. And also, too, I read an article the other day about Phil Ruffin. And I don't know if you recall who he is, but he's the guy that bought Treasure Island in back in the GFC when Corian had to sell it because he was worried about going into bankruptcy. And Phil Ruffin came in and bought it for cash, just stole it and turned it around. And he didn't really need to turn much around because the capital structure was flawed. It wasn't that it was, you know, it was producing a ton of cash, but it was just levered up with so much debt.
Hello.
Yeah, exactly. It took me right back to your report. So can you explain what's going on there and maybe some downside, but maybe some opportunities for future investors?
Well, so when you said the word boutique, that kind of set off an alarm bell because boutiques appeal to leisure travelers. Mm. That will come back. So there will be more opportunity in distress in that niche than there will be across high-end hotels in general.
Okay.
But the bottom line is a lot of these hotel chains that are in trouble were up to their eyeballs in debt coming into this. And you listen to the sell side analysts to see, you know, the guys who do commercial mortgage backed securities, and they're like, there's more equity than there was in 2007, 2008. And I'm like, yeah, but you've got a pretty steep assumption on valuation there.
Right.
Perpetuity, right. By the way. And so this crisis comes, and we have more overbuilding in the hotel sector than we've ever had. Mm. Why? Because public pensions have been throwing millions of dollars at private equity real estate funds for a generation. And these guys don't know what to do with the money. So what do? You're Joe Q, real estate developer, and you've got a great idea. And you want to build one hotel in a great place. You found the perfect location, everything. Going to make money, good business model. Private equity guy says, we'll seed you. We'll fund you. You got to build 10.
Right.
Because we have too much money.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with restaurants. Same thing happened with retail.
It's happening now with IPOs, DoorDash.
Same thing's happening with, yeah, I mean, hello, you need one. That's how many of DoorDashes you need on planet Earth. You need one app on your phone that covers all of the restaurants in the world, and that's it. And then it'll be like Amazon, but for food. So, but my point is, the leverage wasn't seen until there was this massive fissure that opened up because of COVID.
Yeah, right.
And all of a sudden, because I'm sorry, but we're on Zoom right now. A year ago, I was in studio when I did interviews, but we're on Zoom right now. A year ago, I was at podiums when I was giving speeches. Now I do it right here in my house. But you can't tell me that Zoom wasn't coming, eventually. Eventually it was coming. It was just, it would have been a lot slower in its development. But we would have had a recession at some point. And at some point, travel and expense budgets would have been cut because they're cut during every recession. And at some point, that technology would collide with a plain vanilla recession. But instead, you have a pandemic. So Zoom is 24/7 in your face. You know, you're Joe Q CFO. You're sitting there watching your kid on virtual school. You're like, hell, I can have all my meetings on this thing too. So you adapt. You immediately adapt. There's a story on the wires today about CFOs and some bad news they've got for the office sector. That's a whole nother can of worms. But first and foremost, You have McKinsey, Bain, you have all these armies of consultants who are continuing to do the projects that used to put them in high-end hotels for a week at a time, and they'd fly home to the family on the weekends.
Right, right.
In business class, you had road warriors. You had armies of road warriors filling up the 50% of commercial mortgage-backed securities that are backed by high-end hotels.
Right. Right. And even before COVID, we had oversupply.
Well, huge oversupply before COVID, but it wasn't exposed. And now it's been exposed massively. And, you know, your Joe Q Holiday Inn Express on, you know, somewhere between Dallas, Texas and the Florida Panhandle.
Right.
And you are just rolling in dough. Your occupancy's 100% because families are driving to take their vacations. So there are some areas of the hotel sector that are going to do really well. Luxury travel will come back for leisure. Business travel will never be what it once was. Ever again. You can hold me to it.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I want to circle back to Janet Yellen and talk about student loan debt forgiveness. Because I was talking to my good buddy Jason Hartman, who's a real estate guy in the residential sector. And, you know, we were thinking through, okay, well, if they come in and just wipe out that $1.8 trillion in student debt, that frees up a lot of balance sheet capacity for those young adults, 18 to, let's say, 28, which I saw in your report, 52% of them live at home right now with their parents. That was just
2%.
I almost fell out of my chair. I could not believe that. But it frees up a lot of balance sheet capacity for them to go out and buy their first home.
Certainly
does.
So
how do you see that playing out?
Well, first of all, I think we're going to have an FHA bailout. I think that that's step one. I think you're going to have a full-blown FHA bailout because FHA delinquencies are pushing 18% pre-third wave, pre-second round of shutdowns in America. So it's just quiet, right? I mean, and the Democrats aren't freaking out yet, because the CARES Act covers forbearance and foreclosure moratorium through end of Q1 21.
Okay.
So the Democrats are like, okay, we can get the banks, we can get the lenders to, in perpetuity, never collect these mortgage payments. At some point, the banking lobby is going to say, I've had enough. If you want campaign contributions for the midterms, you're going to need to let me collect on that mortgage or pay it. Uh-huh. 40% of all FHA borrowers need down payment assistance.
Right.
They don't have the money. They'll be upside down in 5 minutes if you let the foreclosures. Conservative estimates put 1.1 million foreclosures tomorrow if forbearance ends. Tomorrow. Wow. So you can't let it happen. You can't. The Fed knows it. They own more than a third of the MBS market. And they're struggling because prepayments are eating them alive. I see the FHA bailout first.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about this mini blue wave and sweet Janet at Treasury. So you pay off all the student debt as well. You bail out anybody in FHA so they don't lose their homes. is income growth going to be enough to make those down payments? Probably. So you also set up a program to help millennials get out of their parents' homes. And yes, but these are going to be entry-level homes. So the builder that can make money building a true single-family starter home is going to do really well.
Yeah, but see, I don't know if that's possible, because what we've seen since 2012 when I got into real estate is there's very little supply, if any, being built with these starter homes. And, you know, the politicians like to come out and say, oh, these greedy builders, they only build these McMansions because they're just, you know, profit hungry. Well, no, it's not because they're greedy. It's because they can't make a profit by building these smaller homes due to the increase in construction cost, labor, and regulation. So I don't know how that comes back.
And by the way, riddle me this. What happens if you get the blue wave and sweet Janet and inflation and no growth? Yeah. What's a home builder going to do in a stagflationary environment when their commodities costs are going through the roof? But yet the economy is not growing. Because remember, does anybody remember the 70s?
Yeah. So what happens to residential in that environment? I mean, do we just see like the oversupply of McMansions kind of the price just stagnates, and then the lower end of starter homes and good neighborhoods, the price just keeps going up and up and up, up. This new balance sheet capacity until they're maxed out once again? And I mean
George, you had $100 billion of cash outs in the third quarter. We are back at 07 levels.
Yeah.
It is party time. Fannie and Freddie, they're doing automated appraisal waivers for like, their footprint in the refinancing market is enormous. 11% of purchases are automated appraisal waivers. You want to get some home price appreciation going? Just call up Jay at the Fed and say, Jay, you, me, Fannie, Freddie, you and me, we're all going to get together and we're going to create overnight in a time compression vacuum, a housing bubble. Let's do it. And then Jay gets to go up to the podium on Fed Day and say, interest rate sensitive sectors of the market are doing extremely well, like housing. Well, no shit. Excuse me.
Yeah. But I'm trying to reconcile this chart that I'm looking at toward the end of your report that's called the ignored housing crisis. And I'm looking at it. It's the likelihood of eviction or foreclosure. And I mean, the best state is Utah, and it's still within the range of 15 to 20% of mortgages are in that category. I mean, that's shocking. And it goes up to states like in the Midwest and Texas, where it's over 39%, 39 to 56%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I guess it's just every single person that is actually making their mortgage payment is doing a cash out refi. Is that what we're dealing with?
Of course they are. But we're also sitting on record levels of home equity.
Yeah, right.
So money's there for the taking as long as home prices stay up. .. But you answered the question earlier. There's no mystery in that map that you're looking at. No mystery at all. We've only built luxury. Even apartment developers couldn't make the math work unless they built some stupid high rise with huge rents. How are they doing right now in the middle of those cities?
How are they doing? Because I know prior to COVID, that's one, you know, I don't spend much time in the United States, but when I do come back to areas that I'm familiar with, such as Las Vegas, and now I'm in Phoenix, that I go through these parts of town that used to just have basically nothing. And now it's nothing but apartment complexes and multifamily. And you think, okay, well, at some point they have to have overbuilt this. And so how are those numbers looking?
Well, the thing about apartments and offices is the lag time. We saw hotels blow up overnight. There was no lag time there. But longer leases kind of leave you in the dark for longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this massive overbuilt asset sector in commercial real estate. You've got everybody fleeing urban centers.
Right.
And moving out to suburbia because the average CFO in America today there's a report out that's like, I think we can do this work from home thing forever. So this is such an accident waiting to happen, but we're not going to see it. We're seeing apartment delinquencies tick up. But that is going to be another sector where oversupply is just choking the sector. People, yeah, they just don't realize it. And remember pre-COVID. What happened pre-COVID? Senior citizens were starting to sell their homes because 80 is the new 50 and move into city centers, so they didn't have any home maintenance. They wanted to live in hip millennial homes in these high rises too. So you had a double demographic pouring into these high rises. And senior citizens no longer want to be in an elevator.
Yeah.
They might not ever want to be in an elevator again. They might be, you know, scarred from this episode. So, I mean, my mom lives in a suburb of College Station where Texas A&M is in a ranch I bought her. It's, you know, people can't even find it on a map. She's really happy she's there. She's not alone.
Yeah. So you have this oversupply of high rises and multifamily in the city center, and then a dramatic undersupply. And who knows if there's ever going to be more supply come online of these starter homes in the suburbs. That's what we're dealing with.
You also worked your way into a solution of sorts.
Yeah, let me hear the solution.
Well, it's not a good solution if you're a real estate developer, but if you have a situation where the economy stagnates and you've got this huge house and you want your millennial kids to make grandbabies, for God's sake, I want grandchildren. Mm. What do? You turn into Italy.
All right.
You just bunk up. Yeah, multi-generations under one roof. You got the space. You built the big house for you and your husband. And you've got all these bedrooms. Just move on in and stay on in. And then The kids inherit the house when mom and dad die.
Yeah, I think that's what we're going to be seeing more and more of in the future. And I know spending a lot of time in South America, that's typical. You see multi-generations in the same house, and it just kind of, you stay there and it passes from one group to the next group. And that's just kind of how you live.
Yeah, I mean, we're in such a remarkable time in US economic history. It is hard to describe how unique the backdrop is right now, and it and how bizarre, how surreal it is that it comes down to two Senate races in one Southern state. I mean, this is just surreal. And by the way, Democrats are really, really, really worried about these races for more than just they'd love to have a blue wave. Nancy Pelosi has the slimmest majority in the House of Representatives in the past 20 years. Mm. So if she loses any of her caucus, any member crosses the aisle, you're going to effectively end up having the Republicans in control of the House and Senate. So everything depends on these two Senate runoffs.
That affects everything that we just talked about, as far as the student loan forgiveness, the MMT, Janet's ability to do XYZ, changing the Federal Reserve Act. That has a lot of systemic effects for the broad economy and just people's lives, everyday people. You know, talking about that with I know you've done a lot of work with the pension funds, mm-hmm. and we all know they're underfunded, mm-hmm. but where are we now in that story? You know, I just go back to these recent IPOs where I did a whiteboard video, and I thought through, okay, well, you've got the VC and they have these huge pools of money, and there just flat out aren't enough profitable businesses to invest in. So what they have to do is they have to find a story company that has a great story. You get a salesman CEO and maybe a CFO that's willing to kind of cook the books or use some creative accounting. And then you take this vehicle public and you just keep dumping money into it to sell $20 bills for $10. But as long as it has a good story, then you have this huge IPO cash out with billions. And, you know, one thing that I heard Schiff talk about, which I thought was interesting, you know, Microsoft in the late 80s, when it went public, number one, it was profitable. But number two, when they went public, they generated like $60 or $80 million, Microsoft. And in inflation adjusted dollars, it would have been like $120 million. Oh, where DoorDash, it just generated over $3 billion. And so it's just to pay these people off. But my point is, it's the Fed lowering interest rates, pushing people further and further out the risk curve to get that yield. We talked about it earlier. I think the VCs are capitalizing on it. But how do the pension funds play into that mix?
So first, a note on the stock market. So after Tesla is added to the S&P 500 today, before Tesla, buddy of mine, Philippa Dunn, does great work. She looked back at the at Shiller's CAPE ratio, the 10-year price to earnings ratio on the S&P.
Yeah.
You can actually, Shiller has found a data set that is what the S&P 500 was before it truly existed. And so he's able to map it back to 1881.
Mm-hmm.
The K. Shiller. Since from 1881 to present day, the stock market valuation is in the 98th percentile. Tesla alone is going to add 10% to the PE. Tesla alone to S&P's PE. So you'd be in the 99th percentile. And pensions have more exposure to the stock market than they've ever had. Right. And you've got quiet little headlines on Bloomberg about Steve Mnuchin looks as if he made sure that one of the private equity portfolio companies got some PPP financing. So you've got these private equity firms that are all in pensions. And don't forget the real estate private equity. They're all in pensions.
Right.
I mean, Jay Powell cannot, this country can't, you cannot have a stock market correction.
Yeah, right.
Because people don't realize, a good friend of mine, Chris Cole at Artemis Capital.
Yeah, right.
He's shown that in long cycles, looking back 100 years, that real estate and private equity are pro-cyclically correlated with public equities. Hmm. Try to run for size. And then you tell me how pensions are going to do. And that's why when we started this discussion today, I said that Senator Toomey was so critical. Because he's holding the line on the relief package in Congress, saying you cannot have the backdoor bailout through the Fed's facility by keeping it alive. You have to let the thing expire because you're worried that the Senate's going to stay red and you want a backdoor way to bail out the blue states when their pensions blow up.
For the average investor listening to this right now, it goes back to the release valve being the dollar. Is that what you're seeing long term?
Yes. I mean, look, I'm not necessarily, I'll let you know on January the 6th, my view on the dollar.
Okay.
Because if we're allowed to go from 2 or 3 trillion in the middle of a crisis to $7 or $10 trillion of deficit spending in one fiscal year, we're going to have inflation. The dollar is going to get trashed.
Yeah.
The Fed will have to monetize the debt. They'll have no choice because nobody else is going to want the paper.
So that's really what people should be focusing on. It's our, the system as it is, or let's say as it's intended to be with the Federal Reserve Act, and that the only thing they can do is we'll call it print bank reserves. If that system stays in place, then we've got a lot of deflationary pressure. But if they change that system, through Janet Yellen, through merging the balance sheets, through MMT, whatever you want to call it, to basically they're now using those bank reserves as legal tender in the real economy. That's what everyone needs to pay attention to. And if we cross that Rubicon, mm-hmm. then we're headed to the path of stagflation.
Basically. Because again, to your point, and to my summer in Venezuela, you cannot monetize your way to prosperity and to real economic growth. You can't do it.
Yeah, right. All right, Danielle, I know you're short on time. I really appreciate the conversation. It's enlightening. We're just bouncing all over the place there with commercial real estate and grandma yelling and everything in between. For those of my viewers who want to check out more about what you do, where can they go?
Quillintelligence.com. This is my post-COVID advertising in-house. Go to quillintelligence.com. Follow me on Twitter at DMartinoBooth, but go to Quill Intelligence. My research is so good. This is just shameless on my part, but I have to toot my horn. My research is that good.
Yeah, it really is. I got this report from Danielle. It's about 18 pages, and I read through it last night and this morning. And actually, you had a couple charts in there from our good buddy, George Goncalves.
George is our special advisor. George works with Quill.
I didn't realize that. Yeah, I've interviewed him. I really enjoy going back and forth with him on Twitter.
He's amazing. He's just amazing. George was, for just a second, when I was at the Fed advising Fisher all those years on the financial markets, George was one of my closest, he was one of my closest sources on Wall Street for 10 years. Before every single FOMC meeting, I would go and meet with George in New York. And we would sit down and talk about the plumbing of the financial system. He's amazing.
Yeah, he really is. So check out Danielle's work. I cannot recommend it enough.
Thank you very much. And happy holidays.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.